This weekend we are talking about Daniel and the Revelation. Is there a way to make this truth that seems to be almost to many past truth, to make that again into present truth? How can these Bible books, Daniel and the Revelation, speak to us today, to people around us today? And this afternoon I will be talking a little more about how people around us today tend to think as a background for what we are going to do tomorrow morning. This morning, I would like to speak about our progressive understanding of Daniel and the Revelation. Because if we say, how can we make Daniel and the Revelation relevant to us and to the people who live today, that seems to suggest that we may be at liberty to take a little different approach to the books of Daniel and the Revelation, and that we can probe for some more additional meaning in those books. Some people feel that maybe all we have to say about Daniel and the Revelation was discovered by Uriah Smith and James White. This morning I would like to suggest that that really is not the case, that history teaches us something else, and that there has been, in fact, a progressive understanding of these Bible books. And then the question that comes at the end, if this is so, if there has indeed been such a progressive understanding, an ongoing renewal of some of our views, then maybe we should not just be content with what we have, but try to continue to read, continue to study. Just as a background, a few verses from the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation starts with these words, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place. He made it known by sending his angel to his servant John, who testifies to everything he saw, that is, the word of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ. Blessed is he who reads the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear it and take to heart what is written in it, because the time is near. And I hope our studies today and tomorrow will help us to do that, to read and to hear what the prophecy has to say to us living in the year 2011. Daniel and Revelation. We Seventh-day Adventists have some specific ideas about what these books mean. Going into the background a little bit, when Seventh-day Adventists in the middle of the 19th century developed their views on Daniel and the Revelation, they did not do so in a vacuum. They were living in a particular world and they had a particular background. They lived in the United States. The United States in the middle of the 19th century was quite thoroughly Protestant. Protestant in the Reformation tradition. Various sub-traditions, you might say, because there were Lutherans who had migrated to the United States, and there were many who were Reformed who had migrated to the United States. And they were there, the Protestants, in all these different groups that you also found in the different places in Europe, because the immigrants brought all these various traditions with them. Our pioneers, certainly the Millerites, were part of that fabric. This was a society in which there was a growing anti-Catholicism. Originally, United States, was the scene of a number of major revivals in the 18th century and also in the early 19th century. And in fact, the Miller movement should probably be seen also as part of this second great awakening, the second wave of revivals that hit America in the early 19th century. In that wave of revivalism, there was a lot of focus on prophecy, apocalyptic prophecy, Daniel and the Revelation. Miller was not the first one to study these Bible books. This was something that was very much en vogue. What was also quite broadly present was an intense interest in numbers. In fact, that is true not only of the way people were reading the Bible, but the United States in that particular period of its history was very focused on giving numbers to everything. Not only that, but American Protestantism was also extremely interested in the millennium. Now, if you recognize that there is only really one chapter in the Bible that speaks about the millennium, there are some other allusions, yes, but the millennium is chapter 20 of the book of Revelation. And then it's a bit difficult to understand how this one chapter has caused so much discussion and also controversy in the United States and beyond. The millennium always was an important aspect of American Protestantism. And people were divided in post-millennialists, pre-millennialists, amillennialists, and various subdivisions of these main currents. Pre-millennialists, Christ would come before the millennium would begin. Post-millennialists, Christ would come after a period of about 1,000 years, either a literal period or a symbolic period. These were some of the things that were in the air when Adventists started speaking about the prophecies. William Miller, of course, although not a Seventh-day Adventist, he never became an Adventist, but he was in many ways somebody who is important for Adventist history. He started out as a deist. A deist is somebody who does believe that there is some higher being, but that higher being is not really directly interested in what happens on this world. But he became, after a number of different experiences, he became a Baptist, and as a Baptist, he became an Adventist preacher, although I have put the word Adventist between quotation marks, because he was not an Adventist in the sense that we are Adventists, but he spoke about the Advent, the second coming of Christ. To see a person like him taking up the role of a lay preacher was not very extraordinary. There were lots of people in those days in the United States who would also do that, study the Bible and then go out and be a lay preacher. Part of that has to do with what has been called by church historians the democratization of American Protestantism. Whereas in Europe, in many ways, what you saw in the churches was a hierarchy of people who were higher and people who were lower, with all kinds of church dignitaries, and of course the idea that those who were higher up would know more about the Bible. There was very much a feeling in the United States that all people are able to interpret the Bible, whether they have studied theology or not. Everybody was in the same playing field. And so the fact that here is Miller, without any formal theological training, having some very pertinent views was not something extraordinary. That was quite well accepted. It's interesting to note that the Miller movement, which was, as it were, the cradle of Adventism, was very interdenominational. The people who were flocking to Miller came from all kinds of different backgrounds. There were Methodists, there were Baptists, there was Presbyterians, even some Roman Catholics. They came from all different backgrounds. And they listened to him, and what united them was an interest in prophecy and what the future would bring. Now, Miller was an ardent premillennialist. That is to say, from the very beginning, he believed that Christ would come before the millennium would come. And in his approach to prophecy, he was, like most of the people of his days, a very strong historicist. Now, we talked about that term last night. That means he adopted the view that prophecy, Daniel and Revelation, has to do with the full flow of history. It's not something that is just valid for the first centuries, or something that will only apply to the very end of time, but the prophecies are being fulfilled in 25 centuries of history and church history. Miller had some rules for the way he interpreted the scriptures. He said that he used no other sources but his concordance. Now, although that may be technically true in the sense that he may not have consulted books actively, it must also be remembered that Miller was a very avid reader, and he had read throughout his life lots of books on theology, but in particular also on history. So it is not so strange that Miller could write about some of the applications of prophecy in history, because he had read a lot of history. He was not quite as blank, maybe, as he sometimes said he was. But when he started preparing his viewpoints, his sermons, his lectures, he said he just used a concordance. And if he found a word, then he looked for that word and looked at all the texts that he could find in the Bible that contained that word. And he believed that by doing so, he would then find places where that word was explained. So maybe if it wasn't particularly clear here, then by looking at some other texts where the same word was used, you could find the meaning. And he believed that you should always follow as literal a meaning as possible. He would only look for a symbolic meaning if the literal meaning didn't make sense. From the very beginning also, Miller was convinced that there were time prophecies in the Bible, and that where you find these time prophecies dealing with so many days, 1260 days, 1290 days, 2300 evening mornings days, that one day equals 1 year. And he refers time and again to those two texts in Numbers and Ezekiel, which suggest that in those particular settings, a day reflects a year. Now, Miller did not spend much time proving that that theory is correct. He assumed that that was correct, and he was not the first one to use it. It had been a theory that had been quite current, and was quite current among Miller's contemporaries. So it is something that, rather than being studied in depth, was more or less accepted as common knowledge. A day in prophecy is like a year in real time. And so with those rules, Miller studied the scriptures, in particular Daniel and the Revelation. And after he had studied for some years, he started to preach about it. He wrote a number of his lectures that were later put by one of his colleagues in a book. And of course we have that book, and so we know exactly what Miller said, what he preached when he went around and increasingly had large crowds to hear him. Now, how many people Miller reached, we don't know, but it's safe to say that he probably preached to more than 500,000 people. So this thing, the Miller movement, was something that was quite big. He had certain views on Daniel and Revelation and the time prophecies, as I just said. But continually there was this emphasis on the second coming of Christ, and gradually he moved closer to setting a date in 1843, 1844. At first, Miller was very reluctant to set a date. But in fact, there were some of his colleagues that moved him, and Miller gave in not very long before event was supposed to happen. Miller, of course, was disappointed when it didn't happen, but he continued to believe that his calculations had been correct. At least the idea behind it was correct. But there must be something that where he had gone wrong. But he believed until his death in the soon coming of Jesus Christ. However, without going around preaching anymore, and without becoming part of the small group that would become the later Seventh-day Adventist Church. What is very interesting to note, that in the lectures of William Miller, he says very little in terms of anti-Catholicism. Whereas that became a hallmark of the traditional Adventist understanding of Daniel and Revelation, that is hardly present in the lectures and the writings of William Miller. The reason, at least one of the reasons, as I said earlier, there were hardly any Catholics in Miller's days. The great wave of Catholic immigration into the United States was later in the century. The Miller movement knew many publications, and the names we often see today, Signs of Our Times, Midnight Cry. Many of these publications went far and wide. He was not alone. There were some key leaders from other churches who teamed up with him. And gradually, as they were preaching that Christ would come in October 1844, which was the seventh month of the Jewish calendar, hence the seventh month movement, the last phase of the Millerite movement before the Great Disappointment. Increasingly also, they were running into trouble with some of the other denominations who were getting somewhat upset about this date setting and some of the extremism and fanaticism that went with it. And so some people who were followers of Miller were told that they could no longer be members of their church. And in this animosity that was beginning to originate, there was on the Miller side also a reaction. Come ye out of Babylon. These people who were rejecting the message of the soon coming Christ, they were what the prophecy called Babylon. And now it was time, now that the churches were turning against the Adventist message, the Advent message, I should say, now it was time to come out of Babylon. So you see, there are some of the elements that we find in later Adventism, but it's still in many ways not quite the same. In early Adventism, and we go very, very quickly, in early Adventism, once a nucleus of Seventh-day Adventist believers was formed, many of the ideas of Miller were taken along. There was the adoption of the historicist approach, this approach that prophecy fulfills in the course of history. Second coming of Jesus Christ remained the key focus. At first, they were working with what is called the so-called shut door theory. That means that the earliest pioneers believed that the door of grace had been shut, as in the parable. And so, those who had accepted the message, they were in, and those who had not accepted the message, they were out. And there is quite a bit of discussion as to whether Ellen White was an adherent of the shut door theory, or whether she was from the beginning an open door proponent. And I think all the historical evidence points to the fact that she also did not have full light on that matter at the beginning, and for a few years she also belonged to those people who believed that there was no more mission to be accomplished. The message had been preached, and for those who had not obeyed, the door of grace had been shut. As the 1850s and the 1840s and the 1850s wore on, this nucleus of Adventist believers discovered the Seventh-day Sabbath. It was introduced by somebody who had been a Sabbath keeper all along, a Seventh-day Baptist. And this would happen time and again in early Adventism, that people who had come from a different background would bring in certain things that they had believed and felt were biblical and should now be shared with this group of Bible-believing Christians. And so there is the Sabbath that is being introduced, and soon there is a link established between the Sabbath and the interpretation of prophecy. The Sabbath becomes a hallmark of loyalty to God in the end of time. And so the Sabbath Sunday controversy is seen not only as a matter of which day do you keep, but a matter of loyalty in the great end time conflict. And of course, one of the key doctrines of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, the sanctuary doctrine, is directly linked with the discoveries that were made in that early formative period of Adventist history, together with the manifestation of the spirit of prophecy. So some of the key elements that would characterize Seventh-day Adventism were being discovered and were being put together and were interwoven with the prophetic interpretation, the interpretation of Daniel and the Revelation. The key thought leaders were, and I've listed a few here, and the first name I've listed is Joseph Bates. All the evidence that we have now points to the fact that probably he was the key person in the development of Adventist doctrine. Even more so than the others that I have listed, James and Ellen White, Uriah Smith, and G.N. Andrews, although they were also extremely important. The development of a systematic understanding of Daniel and the Revelation goes back in many ways to a series of Bible studies in the late 1840s, early 1850s in Battle Creek. Now, Battle Creek, that little town in the middle of Michigan, became a center of early Adventism. And there, in the church in Battle Creek that had been formed, it was decided that there would be a weekly study of the books Daniel and the Revelation. That weekly series was started by James White. They started with Revelation rather than with Daniel. James White, after a little while, became sick. James' health was not the strongest, as many of you may know. And so James became sick, and then the question was what to do. It wasn't quite clear who could take over. So just at a time when they were dealing with the trumpets, they just resorted to the views of one of the Millerite leaders, and they read from his books and tried to find what he had said about the interpretation of the trumpets. Then it was decided that Uriah Smith, the young writer, editor, would take over, and he started his lectures, his studies on the book of Revelation from there onwards. He went through the whole book with the church in Battle Creek, and then the book of Daniel. And then, as so often happens, when people have given a series of lectures, they think, well, maybe there is some more mileage in this. Maybe I can write it up into a series of articles, or I can make a book out of it. And so he decided that he would put this in a book, greatly encouraged by the other early leaders like James and Ellen White. And so that is the beginning of the first edition of Thoughts of the Revelation and Thoughts of Daniel. Now, it should be noted that that title was chosen rather carefully. It did not suggest that this was the definitive exegesis, the definitive interpretation of these Bible books. These were thoughts on the Revelation and thoughts on Daniel. The words have always remained on the title of those two books. And even today, if you look hard, you can find that the book is still in print. But the idea that these are thoughts is often forgotten by some people. And even today, there are people who feel that this is the definitive way in which we also today should interpret Daniel and the Revelation. Some of the key concepts that were emerging was, first of all, this idea of the commandment-keeping remnant. God's people could be identified as the remnant, and one of the main characteristics of this remnant was that they were keeping the commandments, and the Sabbath, of course, being a very important aspect of these commandments, because there really you have the seal of God, which shows that God's ownership over and against the mark of the beast, which is the seal, the sign of belonging to the other side. So this idea of self-identity, this is who we are. We are the remnant. We are God's commandment-keeping remnant. And we are entrusted with a particular message, the three angels' messages. In addition to this, there was developing the great controversy concept, which has become so basic to Adventism. History is not just happening. There is something beyond what we see. There is a cosmic struggle between God and the powers of evil. Another basic concept that was being developed was the view that was there already with Miller, but had been there with many of the other people who had interpreted Daniel and the Revelation throughout the centuries, that there was a series of empires, starting with Babylon and then ending with a divided empire, divided Europe, which would eventually be finished when the kingdom of God would be established, the stone that would be cut loose without hands. Gradually, the idea of Babylon was getting shape. Babylon was seen, first of all, as fallen Protestantism. The emphasis was in the beginning not on Roman Catholicism, but on fallen Protestantism. Why? Obvious. Because there were far more Protestants around than Catholics. And they had far more trouble with fellow Protestants than with the few Roman Catholics that were around. One of the other key concepts was gradually the development, the further working out of the concept of the judgment being in various phases, the investigative judgment, and then the executive judgment. So, and I'm going very, very quickly, I realize that, but I'm not talking to people who have never heard of any of this, but just to underline that this was a process that took time, but gradually these key concepts that became dear to us developed. In addition, there were other developments. A development in organization. No, at first there was no organization. In fact, our early leaders were against organization. They said, the moment you get a church organization, you become Babylon. So let's avoid that. But that was not a very practical point of view, because if you wanted to build something, if you wanted to have some property, or if you wanted to employ people, obviously, you had to have some kind of organization. So there is a gradual development, with the General Conference being organized in the 1860s and getting its final forms with unions, etc., around 1901. A development in the mission concept. At first, there is no mission, because the door has been shut. We don't need to preach anymore. It's just a matter of waiting it out. Then gradually, the idea, no, we must preach. And we must preach to all nations. Well, in God's providence, the Adventist message had been proclaimed in the United States. And of course, there were representatives of all nations. So, it was mainly a matter of preaching to the Germans who had come, and the Swedes who had come, and the British who had come, to the United States. It was only gradually, in the 1860s and 1870s, that the idea really took hold, that mission means going out, actually going out into all the world, sending missionaries into the world. And so gradually the concept of mission developed. Many of the other doctrines of the Seventh-day Adventist Church developed. In some cases it took 20, 30, 40, or 50 years. You want to read an interesting little book? Look at the books written by George Knight. And he has a little book about the identity of Seventh-day Adventists and explains how what Adventists believe did not just fall out of heaven as a neat package, but was the result of a prolonged study, prolonged discussion. And that was true also in many ways with regard to our prophetic understanding. And that gives rise to the question, now, was this development ever completed? Was it totally finished? Or is that development still going on, maybe? Well, the discussions through the years about aspects of Daniel and the Revelation did go on. There were major discussions in the 19th century about the identity of the daily, as we find in Daniel 8:11, which has to do with the sanctuary. Is this a service in the sanctuary? Yes, some people said. No, some other people said. It is actually a power that has instituted a false service. And so the daily is, in fact, another term for the papacy. There have always been discussions about Daniel 11, the king of the north. Who is he? Many thought, at least for a long time, that it had to do with the power of the Turks, while others, some even from the very beginning, felt it was the papacy. The healing of the deadly wound. When exactly did that happen? Different episodes, different events were mentioned at different times as being the fulfillment of the deadly wound and the healing thereof. No discussion was probably more bitter. And for us nowadays, it may be hard to believe, but was the discussion about the fact which powers are exactly the 10 toes of the image of Daniel 2. A very important date in Adventist history was 1888. In 1888, there was a general conference that met in Minneapolis. The key topic that was discussed in Minneapolis was about righteousness by faith. Are we saved by works, or are we saved through grace? And that was a very, very vital controversy that took place. And eventually, the viewpoint that it is by grace that we are saved was victorious. But that debate about righteousness by faith took place when the atmosphere was thoroughly affected in a negative way by a discussion about the identity of the 10 toes. And there the delegates actually called one another names, because there were those who believed that one of the 10 toes were the Alemanni, and others believed, no, they were not. They were the Lombards. It's hard to believe that people could get so worked up about that detail of prophecy. But discussions have been going on. And what is interesting to note is that in many cases, Ellen White stayed outside of the debate and let others worry about many of those details. Discussions have continued about some of these points that I just mentioned, but also about, for instance, the 144,000 originally. That was seen as a literal number. The number of the saved would be 144,000. Well, when Adventism grew and we went far beyond the 144,000, people wondered whether that could be the right conclusion. And of course, today there are very few who would maintain that the 144,000 is a literal number, pointing out that if you feel that that is literal, then you have to take the other aspects of the description also literal. That is, 12,000 come from each of the tribes, and they're all unmarried, single people. Because that is what we are told, that they have not had relationships with women. Well, that has been a long discussion. Armageddon. It was felt for a long time that this would be a battle somewhere in the Middle East. This would be a military battle. Later on, it was suggested, well, of course, it would be about oil. Today, there are very few people who believe in the Adventist Church that this is a literal battle. But it's generally accepted that here we are dealing with spiritual controversies. There has been lots of discussion about the meaning of 666, Vicarius Filii Dei. It was wonderful for evangelists, of course, to be able to use that, to write that on the blackboard and say, see, it fits. Trouble is, more recently, it has become clear there is no historical evidence that that title was ever used by the Pope. And so really, this application, and there are other reasons why this application is doubtful as well, but the majority of Seventh-day Adventist scholars today do no longer think that 666 could be applied to the papacy. And increasingly, you do not find that any longer in our literature. However, as the time progressed and Catholicism was increasingly seen in the United States as a very major threat, the anti-Catholic sentiment in our church increased, and that was also clear in the way we wrote our interpretations of prophecy. An important element was the publication of the Seventh-day Adventist Bible Commentary in the 1950s, as I pointed out last night. Those of you who have looked at that Bible commentary know that here was a novelty, that when it comes to the interpretation of many different texts, it will say there is one view that says this, and then there are others who hold this, without actually making a judgment as to which one is the correct opinion. So you can see there was quite a bit of diversity of opinion being allowed in this official, semi-official document of our church. The Seventh-day Adventist Bible Commentary continued to use the year-day principle. Now, later, one of the editors of that project, Raymond Cottrell, in an interview said that there had been a considerable discussion among the writers and the editors of the Bible Commentary as to whether they should continue to use the year-day principle. The majority feeling that there were no sound enough reasons to do so. But in the end, he says, we decided to continue to use it for pastoral reasons. Now, whether that is a correct summary of what actually happened, there are very few people now alive who were part of that. In fact, Cottrell himself is not alive either. So it's difficult to find out. But, of course, if that indeed happened, it shows that the principle, the year-day principle, continued to worry many people. Because, yes, it has been used widely through the centuries, but actually beyond those two texts, in the Bible, which do not directly relate to apocalyptic prophecy, beyond that, there is very little on which to build. The great controversy project, concept, and I see my time for this first period is running out. It's nice you have such a big clock to warn the preacher when he should stop. This was, of course, developed to a great extent in that famous book by Ellen White. She wrote about the great controversy concept throughout her lifetime. It became more explicit, and of course her first real great controversy book was published in 1844, be it under a different title. It came out in 1888 in a major revision, and then in 1911 there was a milder version with quite a few corrections, and also the first edition where there were footnotes to indicate that Ellen White had actually borrowed quite a bit of the historical material from other sources. That was not indicated in 1888, but in the 1911 edition that was indicated. It should be noted that that book is quite strong in its anti-Catholicism, but when you compare what Ellen White said in that book in the late 19th century when she wrote it, when that is compared with what other Protestant leaders in those days were saying about Catholicism, actually Ellen White is very mild. And many of the other writers in other denominations were much more vicious, much sharper. Now, there have been other developments. I referred to that briefly already last night. In scholarly and semi-popular publications, you find that they're exploring new ways. There is a lot of attention for the literary structure of Daniel, in particular the Book of Revelation, which indicates that it is not to be just read as a piece of historical writing. We should not read it as if it were the newspaper, but see it more in its poetic, in its original literary beauty. There's no time now to go deeper into that. And many of those writers today within the church are looking in particular, not exactly only what does it mean, what does it refer to, but how does it tell me to become a better person? How does it inform my spiritual life? You find that there is quite a distinction between different writings that are today being published in the Adventist Church. You find the traditional views very strongly defended, for instance, in the Daniel and Revelation seminars that used to be held, but in some places are still being held. You find the traditional view very strongly, for instance, in the emissions of 3ABN and other independent ministries, and you find some writers who are still very, very strong in being anti-Catholic, in exactly following the, or in outline following the views of people like Uriah Smith and others of our pioneers. I have mentioned here some of them. But there are others who place new emphases, who say we shouldn't be focusing so much on all these beasts, but it is about the lamb among the beasts. It's about salvation. And they place less emphasis on some of the things that we used to emphasize. Among these authors are people like Kenneth Strand, a well-known teacher at Andrews University. He died some 10, 15 years ago. Hans Larondel, a fellow countryman of mine, who died early this year, who was the pioneer of a spiritual interpretation of Armageddon and some other details of Revelation. Roy Nadin. And then, in particular, some writers who have their books being published currently, by the Review and Herald and by the Pacific Press, but who have definitely a different emphasis. John Pauline, who teaches at Loma Linda, Ranko Stevanovic, who teaches at Loma Linda and has written a commentary on the book of Revelation, and his brother, Zdravko Stevanovic, who is teaching at Andrews University, who wrote a book on the interpretation on the book of Daniel, and then Jacques Ducan, who has a Jewish background, is an Adventist theologian at Andrews University. You find, and it's only fair to point that out, that there is quite a bit of difference in emphasis between those who follow the traditional patterns and those who try to go new approaches. Now, I have exactly 1 minute to finish at 11 o'clock. The question then is it legitimate to explore new avenues? And that is also what I try to do tomorrow morning. Is that legitimate? Or is that a betrayal of what we Seventh-day Adventists used to stand for? Is it okay to do that? Is it okay to depart from traditional path, or to develop some things, or to place further emphases, or does this jeopardize true Adventism? And of course, you might ask the question, I'm not going to answer that question now, how central to our faith is our traditional prophetic scenario? Some people say, if you forget about some of these things that our pioneers said about the interpretation of Daniel in the Revelation, then you're going against the central tenets of our faith. Well, of course, that raises all sorts of questions. Are all beliefs equally important? Some would say yes, some would say no. And then, of course, look at the 28 fundamental beliefs. Actually, there is very little about prophetic interpretation in the 28 fundamental beliefs. And in your baptismal vow, there is only an allusion to what we would call apocalyptic prophecy. Of course, there is the second coming, but the details of our traditional interpretation are certainly not there. So some of these things would suggest to me that it is legitimate to keep on thinking, keep on studying, and see what we can mine from the book of Daniel and the Revelation, because that is something that we have been trying to do all along in our Seventh-day Adventist history. I saw that the pastor is trying to give me signals, and they have been received. Thank you very much.